I'm Xu Dong, a postdoc at Institute for Advanced Study. Today I'm going to talk about bulk reconstruction. And this is part one. I'm going to mostly focus on interesting things that we have learned in the past few years, I guess past several years, about how to understand the ADS-CFT correspondence. I'm going to first give you some questions on why we think our current understanding of ADS-CFT is still fairly incomplete. So just to review what we have learned so far about ADS-CFT from Mukun's lecture, ADS-CFT is supposed to be a duality between two very different theories. One is a quantum gravitational theory in what is known as anti-de Sitter space. And the other side of the duality is certain large N CFTs living on the asymptotic boundary of anti-de Sitter space. So usually we draw this picture, the interior of the cylinder is ADS, the boundary is where the CFT lives. The usual understanding of ADS-CFT is that this is an equivalent formulation of the same theory. The same Hilbert space, the same Hamiltonian, have two very different descriptions. And we would like to understand how this works. The reason is, in some sense, this is our best understood model of quantum gravity in a non-perturbative way. You may have heard string theory. The usual formulation of string theory is formulated in a perturbative way by what is known as the genus expansion. So that's not yet the full definition of what a quantum gravitational theory should be. However, ADS-CFT is a full definition in the sense that if we really understand how to translate every quantity from one side to the other, which is true if we really understand the correspondence, then we should be able to use the CFT as a definition for what quantum gravity in ADS is. So it is a very concrete example, and it's also an example where we hope we can actually achieve a good understanding. I should mention that this is not the complete story because our universe is not anti-de Sitter space, unfortunately. So we eventually
just a minor detail.
It's a minor detail, as yes, but it's an important detail. So it's a toy model. It's a toy model of quantum gravity that we wish to extract as many lessons as we can, and then eventually we may want to generalize. I also want to mention this is a concrete example where space-time and gravity emerge from a non-gravitational system. So it's a very interesting phenomenon. The non-gravitational system in this case is the conformal field theory. The reason that this is interesting, I think the goal of this lecture and also my lecture for tomorrow is to try to tell you how much our current understanding of how this emergence works. Why can space-time and gravity emerge from a non-gravitational system? This is conceptually important because if we really understood how this worked, then we can try to apply the lesson and take ADS-CFT outside the ADS box. And then coming back to what I said about our universe, then we can potentially generalize the lessons to some expanding cosmology, which is eventually will be a solution, real solution of quantum gravity as opposed to just a toy model. So that's the motivation. Let me now review several things that we have learned about ADS-CFT, just so that everybody is on the same page. We can match symmetries. So there are a list of things that we can match. And when I go to the bottom of this table, we'll find some part which we don't completely understand. So the easiest thing to match is the symmetries. Usually, we match the isometry group of ADS with the conformal group of the CFT, and both groups are OD, 2. And I'm using the standard notation where ADS is in D plus 1 dimension, and the conformal field theory is in D dimension, D space-time dimensions. There are further matching of symmetries in terms of if I have a gauge symmetry in the bulk, it matched to a global symmetry on a boundary. And in particular, this means the generators should also match. When we have a gauge symmetry, for example, a U1 gauge symmetry, we will have a vector potential that is mapped to the current for the U1 global symmetry in the CFT. So that's very simple. Additionally, we can match states. This is supposed to be a duality, so we should map any state from one side to another side. An example of this is that we can match black hole state in the bulk to thermal states in the CFT. And this has been studied in various contexts in a lot of situations. Next, we can match what I call deformations from one side to the source on the other side. This is probably explained in the previous lecture on ADS-CFT, but let me also write it here. So we can match the deformations of the two theory. On one side, we can match the boundary condition. Oh, actually, let me first talk about matching operators, because that would be more natural. Yes?
What does exactly mean that you have a black hole state? I mean, you can have a black hole in the ADS, but what does it mean that one of the states is black hole?
In this particular, when I wrote this down, I'm certainly not being very clear. But what I meant is a mixed state that describes all the microstates of the black hole. So it's analogous to the thermal state, which is not a pure state, but a thermal state. But there are many ways to realize this. You can couple it. You can think of it as tracing out another system where the whole system is pure. But you can also just think about a single CFT in some mixed state. The dual description will be a black hole, which is also in that mixed state. You can also talk about microstates of the black hole, which would be dual to microstates of the CFT, for example, energy eigenstates with some energy excitation, a typical eigenstate, for example, with energy E. So there are lots of ways to understand the matching of the states. Any other questions? Yes?
What do the charges of the black holes correspond to? I guess the spin of the charge.
The charge of the black hole will suppose it's a U1 charge in the bulk. Then the charge of the black hole would correspond to the charge under the global U1 symmetry in the CFT. The way to think about it is if you have a black hole, suppose you have a black hole in ADS. If it's charged, it will have a field line coming out of the black hole. And Gauss's law says, as long as there are no other charges outside the black hole, the flux at infinity should match to the charge of the black hole. The flux at infinity can be matched to the U1 charge of the CFT state. So this is something I'll mention, how to match operator. This is a part where we need actually to match operators. But using that relation, I can match to the charge of the U1 charge of the CFT state. Yes?
So let's say the bulk has a U1 like local symmetry. So is there any intuition of why for CFT?
No,
it becomes global?
There is a simple, maybe one sentence explanation for this. So if we have a local symmetry in the bulk, the way that we see that we should have a global symmetry on the boundary is that usually when we talk about a local symmetry, it means that we can do local gate transformations in the bulk. So there is some gate transformation that depends, is an arbitrary function of the space-time coordinates in the bulk. But usually we want to say that such a transformation should become trivial at the boundary, at the asymptotic boundary of the space-time.
It becomes
trivial means it's space-time independent in that limit. So this will define some symmetry transformation that is arbitrary inside the bulk, but becomes a constant at infinity. And that's why it's a global symmetry. Any other questions at this point? Yes?
The previous lecture mentioned that gauge transformation on the boundary could not be mapped into anything in the bulk.
Yes.
Is there something, does this put a constraint on the limitation of the correspondence, or is that, how does one understand this?
It depends on how you think about it. Maybe the most honest way of thinking about the correspondence is that we have to really give an example of some CFT and then give an example of something that corresponds to a gravitational theory in ADS and then see evidence that suggests the two are the same. In some sense, a CFT, when we write down a CFT, sometimes we have to resort to gauge symmetry for convenience. But the way I think about gauge symmetries, at least from a purely quantum field theory perspective, is that it's a redundancy. It's a convenience so that we can write down a local Lagrangian that describes the theory. There is a different description of any conformal field theory that completely gets rid of the gauge symmetry, which simply talks about local gauge invariant operators and how they merge into each other. This is called operator product expansion. And in that language, gauge symmetry has been completely gone away. It still describes the same theory, it's just a different perspective. And sometimes it's even more useful than the Lagrangian description. So I wouldn't say it's very fundamental. Now you may ask why sometimes ADS CFT is called gauge gravity duality if the gauge part is not fundamental. Now it's become a little speculative. My very limited understanding is that there is a sense that perhaps gauge symmetry has a more than spurious meaning when we try to think about this correspondence. But from a purely quantum field theory perspective, it's just a redundancy. Yes?
What if you have something like a Ahern-Lov-Bohr effect?
In a quantum...
I mean, like in the field theory side?
Mm-hmm. I can always rephrase that into a gauge invariant operator statement. So, for example, I can simply talk about Wilson lines in that case, which are gauge invariant. So it's still in agreement with the statement that to specify the CFT, all the important things are encoded in a gauge invariant description, gauge invariant operators. I might have to use in the case Wilson lines and so on, but it's still gauge invariant. Any other questions? Yes.
I don't know if that's a sensible question, but can you have different states at ADS D plus one with different geometries?
Yes, you can have different, you can have, for example, take the vacuum state and then compare it with the black hole state or thermal state. Then the corresponding geometries will be very different. Yes. Now you can start to ask whether you can take superpositions of them. Certainly in the CFT you can. And in fact, in a recent paper that I wrote with Ahmed and Brian, we investigate what it means in the bulk. But that's beyond the scope of this talk. Okay, let me continue with this table because I think it's fun. There's a sense that we can map operators. After we match the states, we surely can map operators as well. So yeah, so we probably have seen that we can map bulk fields to CFT, to single trace operators in the CFT. Single trace is just a way of giving out what kind of operators are dual to one particle states in the bulk. Double trace, for example, would correspond to two particles, and cubic trace and so on, higher trace would have more particle excitations. So this is what we have usually talked about. And for example, we can talk about a scalar field. You will have a scalar operator there. We can have a vector, or even we can have a metric field in the bulk, and that could correspond to a stress tensor. So there is a one-to-one correspondence in such a way. Yes?
Could you define single-trace operator?
In specific examples, for example, if the CFT is defined using, again, a gauge symmetry with a gauge field, suppose, take an example where the CFT has a SUN gauge symmetry. Then let's further say that we have some field phi in the adjoint of the gauge group, in the adjoint representation of the gauge group. So phi itself is not a gauge invariant operator. Let's try to write down some gauge invariant operator. The easiest way is to take the trace of some polynomial that you make from phi and its derivatives. So for example, if we take this is a gauge invariant operator. To be concrete, I probably should write phi dagger phi. And this is single trace, obviously. And now double trace operator could be something like this. The products of single trace operators are double trace or higher trace operators. Good. Now that we know how to map fields into operators, we can also deform by these operators of field. So this is the deformation I was referring to a while ago. And in particular, we can deform the boundary condition for the field, for the bulk field, and that corresponds to sources for the CFT operators. And finally, let me come to the matching of correlation functions. The matching of correlation functions on the two sides actually have two different representations, which are completely equivalent. The first representation, so let me say this is a part about correlators. The first is known as the, I usually call it the differentiate dictionary. It's usually attributed to Gubser, Klebanov, Polyakov, Witten. The idea is that because ADS-CFT is a statement between the equality of two theories, its partition function should match on the two sides. So sometimes we write down, perhaps not very surprisingly, that the partition function of the gravitational side should match the CFT side. Phi naught on the gravity side is simply the boundary condition. On the conformal field theory side is the source. So let me just define this as some path integral with the action and the source. And then after doing this, we can try to define correlation functions by studying how the partition function changes under insertions of infinitesimal sources. So in particular, this means we can study correlation functions, arbitrary correlation functions in the CFT by doing variations of either the CFT partition function or the gravitational partition function because they are the same. And the techniques for calculating this variation is the Witten diagram that we have seen. So just to draw some examples, we can, for a three-point function, we can do this, where each of this is a bulk-to-boundary propagator. It's simply a way of telling us how to propagate the source to the bulk so that we can compute the gravitational partition function using the saddle point approximation. And we can also do anything, for example, loops, more complicated Witten diagrams. The second method, which is equivalent to the first, is the extrapolate dictionary. And this is tightly related to what I want to say about bulk reconstruction. The extrapolate dictionary means instead of doing the Witten diagrams, yes?
I have a question. So as far as equivalence, mm-hmm. you mean that just in terms of the results we get are equivalent? Because as far as I know, the only try of proving this is this hollow Stanford paper?
Yes, yes.
Did they have some assumptions on when that works in that paper?
I would say at least for scalar fields, it's been shown by their paper. You can wonder what happens for metric and, for example, what happens for the metric field. I'm inclined to believe that the same argument goes through. But for all practical purposes, here I'm just mean the results are the same. Yes.
Which lecture described the Witten diagrams?
Sorry?
In which lecture have we seen the Witten diagrams and the saddle points?
We haven't. Is no, in the previous focus lecture didn't. I think you did. Thank you. So I don't have to do it now. Excellent. So I'm going to. In fact, my perspective is that the extrapolate dictionary is more tightly related to the bulk reconstruction. So let me first explain what it means. This is usually attributed to Banks, Douglas, Horowitz, Martinek. And the idea is very simple. Say we want to compute a correlation function. What we do is to compute the bulk correlation function first, so all the points are in the bulk instead of on the boundary, and then take the boundary limit. So that's very simple. Let me write down what it means. So we might want to talk about the same correlation function. And it's simply a limit, the boundary limit of the corresponding bulk correlation function where the z coordinate is the holographic, the radial coordinate in ADS. Here I'm using the notation where z equals 0 is the asymptotic boundary. So there is some coefficient we need to put in to make this equation right. This is just so that it has a finite limit. Delta is the conformal dimension, which is usually determined from the mass of the scalar field in some standard way. Pictorically, this is very simple. It means that if we want to compute a three-point function, O1, O2, O3, we simply take a limit of the bulk corresponding bulk correlation function and take all the 3 points to the boundary. So you may ask, why is this useful? This seems very obvious. Well, one thing that you can immediately derive from this, because you essentially know this is true for all correlation function, is that you know that this must be true for as an operator statement. So as an operator statement, we say that the operator O in the CFT is a limit, is equal to a limit of the boundary operator. Oh, sorry, of the bulk operator. The boundary operator is a limit of the bulk operator. So you can look at this equation and compute the left-hand side using Witten diagrams and compute the right-hand side using standard Feynman diagrams. And the statement is, so of course the calculation is makes sense in the semi-classical limit in the bulk. That means we're doing semi-classical field theory in the bulk, doing some kind of 1 over n expansion. The statement is order by order in that semi-classical perturbative expansion, the two sides match. Yes?
So in this right-hand side, are we taking the space-time to be fixed, so it's just quantum field theory in curved space-time?
Yes, and if you really want to, you can even do perturbative correction. So you can do corrections which are of order G Newton, where G Newton is the expansion parameter. But semi-classically, we're holding the space-time fixed. That's right.
Thanks. So this expectation value partition function, can I assume that you're computing on the thermal state of the CFT?
You can compute this in any state. You can do it in the thermal state or in the vacuum. So you can, so as long, as
but
long
the maximum or thermal state, or it's really, it's not for every state, right, in the correspondence world.
The correspondence, it has to do with how well we understand how to map one state on one side to another side. In all those situations where we understand how to do this, we can do this. Of course, then you can ask, if I write down an arbitrary state in the CFT, what does it correspond in the bulk? And that's similar to the question that this is essentially a question of bulk reconstruction. And because in the CFT, there is state operator correspondence. So talking about states is the same as talking about operators. That's why in the bulk reconstruction, I will mostly use the language of operators instead. But that captures the same question about states. Yes?
Some non-zero value for the source, then the phi, the bulk field, will have some non-normalizable mode.
Yes.
I'm wondering in that case whether this formula will explode.
Yes. In that case, yes, that's also true. You can just take n equals 1. So this is a 1-point function. And, well, how do you compute? In this particular case, you can write down various versions of this formula, but one of the ways of this equation still works is that you can essentially you are computing the tadpole diagrams. So you can compute something like this, and similarly for the bulk diagram. Essentially, what you are doing in that case is you are extracting. You're extracting the behavior. So in that case, you get a 1-point function for the bulk field here, which is simply the classical value of the bulk field in the semi-classical limit. And you're simply extracting some mode from some coefficient from that by taking this limit. So at the end of the day, you will be getting an equation that says the 1-point function of the CFT operator is equal to the response of the gravitational solution, which is the coefficient of the normalizable mode. The normalizable mode behaves like z to the delta, so So it precisely cancels with z to the minus delta in that case. Good. Once we have this as an operator equation, then it's a very powerful statement because it says it at least expands the matching of the field and operators on this line, because this line doesn't really tell me how to map individual operators from one side to the other. It just categorically tells me if I have some bulk field, I should think of it as corresponding to a boundary operator. But this equation is much more refined in that it says I can really, I know how to build local, at least single trace operators in the CFT from operators in the bulk. And of course, once I have single trace operators, I can, in principle, I can take the products and build more complicated multi-trace operators. And if I have all the local operators, I can simply try to build all the non-local operators by doing some expansion. So this is a very powerful statement. It tells us how to go from the bulk to the CFT. Now, the question, I think really the interesting unresolved question is how do we do the opposite? How do we back up away from the limit and represent bulk operators using CFT operators? So that's going to be the question I'm going to focus on for the rest of the talk. Yes?
Maybe this is the thing that Daniel was talking about in terms of commutative and boundary, but like that operator there, that field there is defined in the bulk, but this seems to be like, regardless what Z it has the same, corresponds to the same operator. Is that the sensible thing? Because if I want to think about why is it that I have this redundancy that all these local operators, all these local fields correspond to the same boundary operator?
It is related. I'm going to mention the commutator thing in a moment. It is related, although I should point out it, one should really think of this as taking the limit. So O is only defined if you strictly take the limit, take the bulk operator to the boundary. But I'm going to come back to the commutator issue in a moment. Any other questions? Yes?
Maybe related to that question. If we have a black hole, a state with a well-defined geometry and another state with a different well-defined geometry, one with a black hole and the other without a black hole,
okay.
Does it make sense to look at a reduced density matrix away from the black hole and ask whether the two states are similar or not?
When you say reduced density matrix, do you mean taking it in the bulk or in the CFT?
In the bulk.
We don't precisely know how to do that in this context. Because in the, if we are doing...
geometry is well-defined?
Yes. Well, we know how to do it in the effective field theory. Because if we just keep thinking about the bulk space, bulk theory as, for example, a number of particles and maybe gravitons propagating on a fixed background, of course, we can just use the standard rules for quantum field theory there and ask about tracing out part of this region. But we know ultimately this is only an effective description. This is not a truly correct non-perturbative description in the CFT. So this tracing out can be done in the bulk effective field theory Hilbert space, but not in the CFT Hilbert space. It depends on what you want to do it. Maybe it's better to postpone it a little bit because eventually, once we understand how the two Hilbert spaces are related to each other, it's better then to ask what a question about tracing out part of the bulk region. But tracing out the boundary region is always well-defined up to certain issues about gauge symmetries, which I think can be resolved by UV completions. Good. OK, let me then just put a question mark here. What is the question is, how do we build the bulk operator from the CFT? And I should mention, this is a good place to mention that if we know how to do this, then we know how to compute arbitrary bulk correlation functions, because we simply map the question to a CFT question. Suppose we have a powerful enough computer to simulate the CFT, then we should be able to answer arbitrary correlation. We should be able to find arbitrary correlation functions in the CFT. That gives the bulk correlation functions in the bulk. At least perturbatively, we can do that. And also, it's a good time also to point out that we know, what we know is that this operator, it has to map to some operator in the CFT, but that operator cannot be a local operator. It's going to be some non-local operator in the CFT. The reason is the following. I'm going to draw ADS-CFT now just as ADS-CFT is usually phrased, picture demonstrated as a cylinder. I'm going to take a time slice, so it's a constant time slice. And suppose I have an operator here. If I want to represent it as a CFT operator, it is probably intuitive that there is no preferred location it should be in the CFT. If I put it in the center, then there is not really any point which is more special in the CFT than any other point. This is maybe not the best reason, but it does suggest that the operator we are seeking in the CFT should be some non-local operator smeared over the entire CFT. There's a better version of the argument that has to do with thinking about holographic RG. The idea is that when we go into deeper and deeper, so when we can take two different directions. One is we can take an operator closer and closer to the boundary. As we know, the operator becomes a local operator in the CFT. A local operator is a very sharp object. It is the most ultraviolet sensitive thing that you can find in a CFT. So this suggests going to the boundary is like going to the ultraviolet of the theory. Oppositely, going into the center or going deeper into the bulk corresponds to the more infrared sector of the theory. An infrared object in the CFT would be some local, non-local operator in the CFT. The surprise is that in certain cases, we seem to be able to find a very nice, very simple non-local operator that completes this equation. So general non-local operator in the CFT is very, very complicated. We probably don't know how to write them down. General operator in the CFT that is non-local could be made, can be represented as sums of products of local CFT operators. It's very complicated. Yes. Yes. Thank you for. Yes. Z should be thought of as a renormalization scale.
So it's not a spatial direction.
It is a It is a spatial direction. It is a spatial direction in the bulk. It is dual to a holographic renormalization scale in the CFT. So that's the statement.
Okay. And between X and Z. Phi is local, or when Z goes to zero, Z becomes more and more non-local.
If Z is not zero, so it is this operator is somewhere in the bulk,
yeah.
Then this is a non-local operator in the CFT. I'm going to write down a formula for that in a moment. If Z goes to zero, then this equation says the limit should be a local operator. This motivates the statement that this is a normal renormalization scale.
So by this field to be local, like, do you mean that it is playing like a Gaussian wave packet around some point and you're going to squeeze it?
I'm going to write down an explicit formula to see how we smear the operator.
Okay. No, I mean the field inside the box.
Oh, inside the box, I'm sorry. In here, I'm just saying that it's a local operator. I'm taking this to be a local operator in the box. The non-local part was meant to refer to the CFT side. So I'm taking a local operator in the box. At least at this point, I'm taking a really, at this level of the discussion, I'm taking a real local operator in the bulk, but then I'm asking what operator in the CFT could represent this operator.
Sorry, but are we talking about like bulk field corresponds to an operator on the boundary?
Yes.
We also talk about the operator in the bulk. So I was wondering the relation between these two.
I'm talking, so we have on the bulk side, we have operators. We can take operators to be at any point. And because this duality is an equivalence between two theories, we should be able to map any operator on one side, for example, in the bulk, to some operator on the other side. That's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, but what is the difference between this bulk operator and bulk field?
Oh, good. Bulk operator is simply meant to be a bulk field at a particular location. Yeah.
But there is a symmetry of ADS that moves this point from the center to the boundary, so...
Yes, that's right.
So the symmetry converts something non-local into something local?
You have to really take the limit to make it local. So if you apply
an expectation value of some fixed state or something like that.
Yeah, in fact, the way that I'm going to write down the completion of that equation will shed light on how to, once we know the answer, it will clear to you, indeed, it will be ADS invariant under the symmetry. It will transform appropriately. So this is the insight of Hamilton, Kabat, Lifshitz, and Lowe. They have a... at least two papers, one in 2005, and the other is in 2006. And they proposed doing the following. We know the bulk operator needs to satisfy the equation of motion, the bulk equation of motion. For example, let's talk about a scalar field for concreteness. So a free scalar field would satisfy the Klein-Gordon equation in the bulk. This is an operator equation in the bulk. We can add interactions. It will affect things at higher order in the 1 over n expansion. So let's for now, talk about a free scalar field. We also know that phi has to approach to a local operator O as we take it to the boundary. So we can think of that as a boundary condition. So I'm just going to borrow that equation from there to here. So we're going to solve this operator equation, differential equation, with some operator-valued boundary condition. It's a linear equation, second order, so we should be able to solve it. The standard way of solving this is to use the Green's function. Where dx prime simply means integrating over all the boundary space-time.
Don't you need the normal derivative to know the normal derivative because it's a second order equation?
Let me say why. Yes, this is a non-standard boundary value problem.
Okay.
So it is not immediately clear whether the supply boundary condition is consistent for solving the equation. In fact, generally speaking, we don't know whether the solution exists or whether it's unique. There is no theorem that guarantees the uniqueness and existence of solutions for this kind of boundary condition. Let me just point out why I say it's a non-standard boundary condition. It's evolving radially as opposed to evolving in time. And the boundary condition, and also I intentionally didn't say how much in what region I should apply this boundary condition. So you might automatically think I should apply it on the entire cylinder, or you may want to apply it for only a subregion. I'm going to discuss that in a moment. Another question?
Yeah. Is there any reason, so this equation basically assumes ad hoc that the bulk operator is a sum or an integral with some coefficients over operators, local operators.
Yes.
And that's sort of, why don't you have products of operators? Or?
Yes. From this perspective, the reason we don't have products at this point is because products enters at higher order in the expansion. So suppose that we considered an interacting scalar field as opposed to a free scalar field. We would add, for example, lambda phi squared to the right of this equation instead of writing down zero. So that would be the cubic interaction in the bulk. We can then suppose lambda is small, so of order 1 over n, which is true in a large class of ADS CFT examples, then we can first solve this to order lambda to the zero, and then iteratively find a better and better solution as an expansion in lambda. Products of O's will appear at higher order in that expansion. In some sense, the reason we're finding such a simple non-local operator here is because it satisfies a simple equation with a simple boundary condition. And that's the reason why. Of course, this doesn't really tell us why for certain CFTs we can find simple bulk operators. Suppose we didn't know about the bulk. Suppose I give you only the CFT. It's kind of a mystery why you can form these nice objects that satisfy nice equations and boundary conditions. Perhaps at this level is not that mysterious, but if you go to higher and higher order in lambda, it will become increasingly mysterious why you can do this consistently.
So somehow the orders in the dual theories match.
Yes, there's a non-trivial constraint on the CFT data for which this can be done order by order in the lambda expansion or 1 over n expansion. That's right. Here we're using the fact that we know the CFT has a gravitational dual to help us deduce what's the right object to consider in the CFT. So we are kind of putting in that the duality is true, but eventually we want to understand why this happens. So we want to do the opposite. Yes?
Naive question. So if this delta is positive, like, do you need to worry about the divergence of this operator?
This operator, do you mean operator phi?
OX, y, z equals to 0, like there is a divergence.
The behavior of the phi operator is such that as you take the boundary limit, the leading behavior is z to the delta. So it's precisely extracting the coefficient.
Okay.
So just by solving this equation, you find that asymptotic behavior can be z to the delta. And that's, in fact, the right branch to pick when you pick out the CFT operator. Yes?
Isn't one of the biggest problems here that we're assuming the bulk equation of motion?
It is an input. As I mentioned, we are putting in that this holds. So we're trying to learn what the consequence for that is. Eventually, the idea is we want to understand the consequence so that eventually we can create some set of criteria for understanding the CFT so that we can understand the condition for this to be true. Yes?
Question, do you actually need to assume
you're working in, do you actually need to specify if you're working in global or
quantum? I haven't done that yet. So you might be tempted to think about concrete ADS because I use X and Z, but let me be more general here. So I have not specified which part of ADS I'm focusing on. That, in fact, is my next point. Very good. So let me talk about various versions of this for which we understand how this works. The K here is usually known as a kernel or smearing function. Before I go to various patches, I want to mention that you may confuse this K with another K that you've seen in the previous focus lecture. There, K was meant to be the bulk-to-boundary propagator. Let me emphasize that the K here is not the bulk-to-boundary propagator that you've seen used in the Witten diagrams. Let me point out what the difference is. So in this lecture, K always means the smearing function for constructing bulk operators from CFT operators. To emphasize the difference, I'm going to write the bulk-to-boundary propagator as K Witten. There are two differences I can point out. One is they are created for different goals. In the Witten diagram, we want to compute the partition function, the change of the partition function with respect to a small variation of the sources. So the bulk-to-boundary propagator there is supposed to propagate boundary conditions for fields into the bulk. So evolves phi naught, the boundary condition, to ADS. The goal of the smearing function in this discussion is to evolve something different. It's evolve the operator O in the CFT, not the source, but the operator itself, to ADS. From the CFT perspective, phi naught and O are conjugate variables. So one is the source for the other. Phi naught is the source for the operator. We're evolving different things into the ADS geometry. And from a technical level, both of these two satisfy the Klein-Gordon equation, or whatever equation of motion we have in the bulk, but they have different boundary conditions. As z goes to 0, the boundary condition for k can be read off, can be obtained from here. It says that k has to behave like z to the delta times a delta function on a boundary. That's the definition of this Green's function. So for the bulk-to-boundary propagator in calculating Witten diagrams, it's z to the d minus delta times a delta function on the boundary. So the falloff is different. One is normalizable, the other is non-normalizable.
So in short, like you solve Klein-Gordon equation, I mean for both this case, it's like and match different boundary conditions.
Yes.
Okay.
So you simply solve the same equation using a different boundary condition. That's correct. And again, this is a non-standard boundary condition. So I haven't addressed yet how to actually do this.
The boundary condition that you have up there, you're imposing that because you're assuming that the field has a dual?
Yes, I'm assuming that the field has a dual, so this equation holds. Again, the reason that we know this comes from assuming that the theory has a dual and then using what we know about gravitational physics in the bulk. We know that the theory in the bulk has a Lagrangian, at least for at low energies, in terms of some standard K kinetic term and mass term for phi. And from there, we deduce, we know, and we also know a piece of the dictionary that relates from phi to O. So from that two pieces of data, we can then write down a solution, which somehow must be true if we assume that a CFT has a holographic dual.
When you say you assume it has a holographic dual, is this a precise statement, or do you mean that it has a dual under some? I mean, we don't know that the HKLL. It's not that you have a definition of the dual. You just assume that there is some dictionary.
I should perhaps mention the way I think. For me, assuming that the CFT is a dual means the following. If we look at the equation in the very top, it says two partition functions are the same. We know how the CFT partition functions are defined. It's over there. Having a holographic dual means the gravitational partition function can be effectively written as also a path integral, but now a path integral in the bulk. The bulk path integral involves some Lagrangian in the bulk that, for example, if it has a scalar field, we will write down a kinetic normal Lagrangian for the scalar field. You will also have the standard Einstein-Hilbert action for the metric, and so on. So that's what I mean by having a holographic dual. There is a description, at least order by order in the 1 over n expansion, there is such a description. And that's a very non-trivial statement. I have a few more minutes. Let me tell you in what circumstances we know that this is true. Well, at least we can find an example of the smearing function so that we can check that this is satisfied, both the equation of motion and the boundary condition. There is a general procedure, which I'm going to describe tomorrow, that tells us how to solve for the K. But today, let me just give you a few examples. There are a few examples, the first being global ADS. And for simplicity, let me look at an operator in the center. So I'm going to set Z, well, the coordinate of the bulk field to the center here. The idea is that there is a smearing function that I can write down that has support on part of the space-time, CFT space-time. The way to construct it is to first find this region . So what I've done is to, for the operator at the center, I can find a region between these two circles or spheres defined so that all the points in this band is space-like with respect to the point in the center. So just to recall that the way that we have Penrose diagram is so that light-like directions are 45 degrees. So I've drawn two lines, essentially two planes with 45 degrees. Now, the idea is that I can find a K. There exists a K such that the support of K is within this band between the two circles. This is usually called the ADS, global ADS reconstruction. I'm going to write down an explicit formula for this K in one line in the next lecture. But let me also point out another example where the support of K is much smaller. And that's going to be, I'm considering the same point, but now I'm going to do something else. you've probably seen this picture in other places. The idea is we can first pick out some constant time slice, which is, let me use a different picture. The constant time slice is this blue circle. And the point that I'm trying to describe is in the center of that circle. I'm going to divide the circle into two halves. So the first half is the left region, which I'm calling A. A is the half circle here. The idea is that I can define a wedge associated to this region A by using these two 45-degree planes to cut the cylinder, and it will give me this wedge. This is the ADS-Ringler wedge. And let me describe it as this. So the idea is that there also exists a K for which the support is equal to the ADS-Ringler wedge. Remember the wedge. I'm sorry. I said incorrect thing. I'm sorry. The support is now the part of the ADS-Ringler wedge which corresponds to the boundary on which the CFT lives. So if we think about the wedge, which is some region in ADS, it will contain part of the CFT boundary. That part of the CFT boundary is where the support of K lies. The support, that part of the boundary is usually called the domain of dependence, whose general definition I'll also provide tomorrow. So I think I'm out of time. Thank you for your attention. Any questions? Yes?
You can deform informally that to get the sphere around it.
Yes, yes. So here I'm done half a circle. You can then move the points around to get any circle, or generally any spherical region. And generalization to non-spherical region requires some concept in Mukun's lecture tomorrow.
So what's the relation between D of A and WR of A?
Oh, for this example, let me first simply define D of A as the intersection of the ADS-Ringler wedge with the boundary of ADS, which is the cylinder itself.
So in the first case, like the support on the boundary is space like with this.
Yes, yes.
Why
space like? Yes. In fact, this is a good question. In fact, if you try to solve this problem, you find that the solution is not unique. And this has to do with the non-uniqueness I mentioned earlier. In fact, you have multiple choices. In fact, infinitely many choices. You can have a K which is not constrained to this region, but has the entire CFT. But you have a freedom, and there is a way to maximally use that freedom in shrinking the size of the support of K in this case. That essentially corresponds to adding some piece of K which cancels out the support outside this band, but does not affect this integral. So tomorrow I'll I'll describe how to actually find this K in this case. I'll describe tomorrow why you can add some function to K while preserving the operator, while preserving this integral. But now let me just say that there's a freedom in doing that, and maximally using that freedom gives this support. So in some sense, it's the most optimal thing you can write down. It's not the unique thing, but it's in some sense the best thing.
So after you do this, like maximally, and this K is unique?
Yes.
And is there any intuitive way, like, I mean, this point, for example, this point?
No, I should say that, of course, you can also do that. So,
but it's smaller than the cup.
But it's more, it's very different. So I should say that this D of A is a proper set of this band. So just because we can also do that means that certainly if we ask the question in general, it's not going to be unique, even if we focus the support on the band. What I mean is that you can, this probably is a question that it's best to explain once I give a way of finding this K by solving this equation. So it will become clear in what sense within the class of global ADS reconstruction, not worrying about ADS Ringler, you can naturally find this smearing function with a support in the band.
It's known that there is no reconstruction with smaller thing that the Ringler can give.
For a fixed point?
Yeah, for a fixed point.
You can certainly do some non-optimal thing. I realize I should have pointed out something, which is that there exists a K that has this support for any point inside the entanglement wedge. So the picture I've drawn has the bulk point on the edge of the entanglement wedge, which is kind of a marginal case. So I should have drawn a better picture and moved the point to the inside, to the interior of the wedge. And now to answer your question, can I do better? Well, now I've changed the picture. Of course, I can do better because I can just consider a smaller Ringler, ADS Ringler wedge, which still contains that point. So if I fix the point that I want to construct here.
Yeah, you fix the point.
Yes.
Then you have a set of Ringler wedges.
That's right.
So there is something smaller than one of these. Because these are not included in each other, right? These are like
you can they can overlap, but they don't have to include each other. That's correct. And then you want to.
It cannot be reconstructed in something smaller than that.
Because to really answer your question, one has to and how to do it for non-spherical regions, or maybe you can simply ask of all the spherical regions, what is the smallest? So the reason that I'm a little hesitant is because even for spherical regions, if you try to push on it, you will eventually find a smallest ADS Ringler wedge for which the point is lying on the boundary. That's what you will find because you will just keep decreasing the wedge. But also, it's not unique because you can rotate. Once the ADS Ringler wedge has an edge for which the point is lying on, you can do this in a non-unique way because you can rotate the wedge while making the point always lie on the edge of the ADS Ringler wedge. So in that sense, definitely the answer is there's no smallest one because they overlap. But I would also be hesitant to consider the marginal case as well.
Isn't the smallest one just the case where the Ringler wedge is the causal wedge at that point on the outermost tip? I mean, you could slide it around, but if you slide it close to the boundary, then you'll need a bigger region on the boundary.
I haven't yet introduced the causal wedge yet, but here in this particular case, the Ringler ADS Ringler wedge is identical to the causal wedge.
Right. But then there is a unique smallest one that includes that point.
The point I wanted to say is because you can choose different ADS Ringler wedges, which do not overlap. Let me draw a picture maybe of a picture of this constant time slice. So suppose your point is here. You can consider AVS Ringler wedge that corresponds to this region, or you can consider AVS Ringler wedge that corresponds to this region. And you can do many other things. So in that sense, it's not unique.
Okay.
Any other questions?
I don't know if it makes sense, but what did, I mean, this is to express the bulk operator as a function of space-like points. Does it make any sense to do that for time-like?
You want purely time-like support? And perhaps you would be happy if I do it in a global ADS case. I'm not 100% sure, but I think there should be a way to do it.
And the picture should, I mean.
I think the redundancy that I'm going to talk about tomorrow will help answer that question, because that's the part where you can move the support from one region to another region by adding functions that integrates to zero with respect to O. So maybe let's leave it to tomorrow. Yes? Boundary exponential decay, by that you probably meant exponential in n, because the correlation function commutators for space-like points, space-like separated points in the bulk, to arbitrary order, to all orders in the perturbation theory is zero from the bulk perspective. To answer your question, the idea is the following. Once you know this, and if you take a commutator, it's not immediately obvious whether space-like points should commute. But if you compute, now you can test whether a commutator between two bulk points are the same by computing the expectation value of that commutator times another set of operators. That's the kind of thing that this formalism is ideal in using, because once you have the bulk point represented as a CFT operators, as I mentioned earlier, you can immediately compute all correlation functions. So in particular, so this is actually being worked out. So you can try to compute some correlation function of phi with another phi at a different point, but you can insert other operators. So for example, you can insert other operators in the CFT. You want to see that this is zero. But you can then write this as a difference between two operators, two correlation functions in the bulk. And the statement is that if you can do this higher order thing correctly, which I haven't written down, but the part which higher order in one of n expansion consistently, then all of this should be zero. Of course, to go deeper in this direction, we eventually will find that this is a huge constraint on what possible thing we can write down a higher order in one of n. So in fact, this is, if we insert simply one operator O, we can use this to figure out something about cubic interactions in the bulk. And once we add more O's, it will be, we can use to constrain the CFT data in a very non-trivial way. And it's a very interesting question of what kind of CFT has that property. The current understanding is that a large N CFT with a gap in the operator spectrum generally will have that property. And it would be nice to see that how to directly see this leads to that.
Which property? The fact that this is here?
Yes. With arbitrary insertion. When x minus x naught is space-like in a bulk. So I didn't write z, but suppose that this x includes the z coordinate. This is the bulk coordinate.
I'll see you tomorrow.